And then I'll just need to think of a fun way to start this episode.
That's what editing is for.
Exactly.
Who makes the cold open first?
Who writes? Nobody does. It's like Smoperville, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Elliot and Ted, I guess. Because are they still our main characters? Welcome to the Smoperville Monthly, everyone. I'm your host, Maplestrip, and today I'm once again with Trek U140. There'll be spoilers here. Yeah, the same stuff.
Hello, I'm back here to talk about my namesake. I could not be more excited.
Yes, this is going to be a fun episode. We have already talked about Star Trek before, but we decided to do it again because we felt like there's still so much more to say, and it's just so important to Elkin and Shive, and it's already getting late, so let's have a fun discussion here. Trekkie, when did you first get into Star Trek?
I had a weird out-of-order onboarding where my very first exposure to anything Star Trek was me as like an 8-year-old casually mentioning, I love science fiction, I would love to see Star Trek sometime, but nothing's airing on TV right now. And so my aunt bought me a box set of the original series of Star Trek movies.
Oh, the movies.
Yes, not the show, the movies.
Oh, that must have been fascinating, because then you started with movie one and you were like, what the fuck did I just watch?
Yeah, I technically had seen 2001 A Space Odyssey before that, so I... And I also found that movie really boring, so Star Trek actually seemed a little bit more energetic than 2001, and as a little kid, I had trouble... figuring out what was going on or who these characters were. But I did like space, and I liked looking at space, so...
And the first Star Trek movie is very beautiful, so...
Yeah, and over the course of a few months, I ended up watching all of them. Which, later in life, learning of the Star Trek movie curse. But looking back on them, I honestly found something to enjoy in all of them. I was totally new to Star Trek, and the motion picture is not a very good introduction to those characters. Wrath of Khan was a much better way of onboarding you into the dynamics of the Enterprise crew.
Yes. This generally just one of the best Star Trek films, if not the best.
Yeah, and even though I had no knowledge of the backstory at all, so I did not know who Khan was, I didn't know why I should care about him, and I didn't quite grasp Shakespearean character drama in the way that I do now as an adult, so...
Oh, I still don't grasp it at all, so...
Some of the themes went over my head. I think I actually enjoyed The Search for Spock more at the time. I remember getting a lot of laughs out of the voyage home. I'm sure I would still laugh at it today.
It's the funnest movie of them all.
Yeah.
Though I have to stand by that movie 5 is really good as well, and I really like it.
Oh, you like the one where they go on a mystic quest to meet God?
Life is but a dream.
That
I think the interactions between the characters in that movie are just so... lovely. It's just so nice. It feels kind of meta, because you kind of feel like they've been through everything together at that point, and it's just nice to see them have a good time together.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't have any animosity towards it either, even though I totally get why so many people don't like it, and I think the plot is kind of stupid, and the production was a huge mess, where they kept drastically rewriting the script.
Yeah.
And William Shatner was directing it himself, and his original idea for the film was so much wackier, but so much less thoughtful at the same time. Where his original pitch for the movie was going to be about Captain Kirk fighting the devil.
Well, they almost did that in the animated series, so.
Oh, that. I did not watch.
That was still so wild.
The animated series is the definition of wild. You're wondering, what were you on when you wrote this?
I'm just surprised that they got away.
Spock has magic powers. He calls them magic in the show.
Yeah, he does. But he can only do magic there because that's a magical area.
And
I love it.
I watched all those movies, all six movies as a kid, had a fondness for them as a kid. But it didn't really pull me into the franchise because I didn't connect. I liked Spock from the word go because he was Spock. I could not like Spock. I have gained a greater appreciation for Kirk and what kind of character he was, especially in Wrath of Khan, where that does a little bit more to interrogate what kind of character he's become over time, now that he's retired from his epic pulp adventure career. or he's no longer the kind of person who runs around the galaxy sleeping with women, fighting and punching bad guys. But there's something to enjoy the other films, and based on my current understanding of Star Trek as a franchise and all the different episodes I've watched, none of the movies are really any worse than your average bad episode of the show.
Yeah, I mean, other than maybe the first one, but.
Yeah. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know what they were thinking with those really with how slow that was.
Well, I'm surprised that, you know, it's basically 2001: A Space Odyssey, and everyone thinks that one's a masterpiece, and I think this one is better than 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I mean, I like 2000. I mean, as an adult, I now like 2001. As a kid, I didn't like 2001.
Maybe I need to try and rewatch it someday.
No, you don't. No, you don't need to do that. You do not need to do that to yourself. Both of those movies are a product of a specific time and a specific creative vision.
There's some beautiful screensavers in there.
Yeah.
Sadly, we don't need screensavers anymore, but.
We have phone wallpapers now.
It's something. Well, what did you watch next after the movies?
Yeah, after that, I was sort of more of a Star Wars kid than a Star Trek kid for a while. Because the movies had a lot of fun and cerebral moments, but they didn't quite grab me. What did grab me was when my mom decided to introduce me to her favorite piece of Star Trek, Deep Space Nine.
Welp.
And yep, that pulled me right in, reeled me right in. That was everything I wanted it to be. Even the first season, that it had like all the weird sci-fi mysteries, but it still had depth and nuance to all of its characters, so I was invested in that drama. And as the drama grew over time, I only liked the show even more. And it really appealed to the storytelling sensibilities I was looking for from television at the time. Because it wasn't purely episodic. It wasn't. It had a lot of character drama driving things, and. The Deep Space Nine characters are absolutely wonderful.
It is, as I think we mentioned a lot in the a few episodes ago. It is just an incredible TV show, and
the
ensemble cast, the Dominion War, all of that. It's just so good. Watching O'Brien suffer.
a Trek tradition, if there ever was one. and I watched Deep Space Nine without seeing Next Generation, so I did not know who Worf was. I didn't know O'Brien had been returning from another show. It's just like, oh, Worf. I don't know why Worf is important, but everyone talks about him like he's important, and my mom seems to really like Worf, so I'm just... And then I really like Worf. I ended up absolutely loving who Worf was, and they do so many cool.
I mean, Klingons in general are just great, so that automatically makes Worf an interesting character.
Yeah. It's a little a little odd to go watch the old shows, the older shows later, and see how much less nuanced alien cultures were than they were in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, especially in the original series. It's just,
Yeah. Again, I have respect for it now and what they were going for and commenting on and who the people and what the goals they had as creators. But man, it's kind of amazing that Deep Space Nine was as good as it was when it decided we're going to add on more development to all these alien cultures that were mostly villains in previous episodes.
Yes. And I think that was also one of the strong points of The Next Generation, when, the Klingons became, I guess, in the last movie of the original movie series, when the Klingons became more of a protagonist species.
Yeah, so it was odd with the order I watched things in, where, wait, the Klingons are villains? I didn't remember, I didn't know anything about Klingon culture until Worf. Worf ended up being in where I learned about what Klingons were like and fell in love with that aspect of the world, that aspect of Star Trek. And they used
Klingons. Because this ship.
They used Klingons in interesting ways for political satire and social commentary.
Because did you watch the other Star Trek series immediately after?
I mean, I'm happy to keep talking about Deep Space Nine as long as you want. I could talk about that for 2 hours with all that.
I know, that's why I'm changing the topic now.
In my timeline of fandom, I absolutely loved Deep Space Nine. I was 1,000% satisfied by the way that it ended. But I still wanted more. I just could not want more Star Trek.
Of course.
And because my mom had been the one who onboarded me to Star Trek, and she had grown up as a fan and of the show, I asked what she thought we should watch next, and she had zero interest in the original series. She hated Shatner's acting.
Can't blame her.
No, she never liked Shatner. As an adult, I've gone back and rewatched stuff. I'm perfectly fine with the acting. It's just distinctly camp for its time.
It's just a very different show.
Yeah, I like camp, and I do. And there's plenty of reasons to interrogate what kind of masculinity Kirk is representative of. But he is.
Oh yeah.
But he is compassionate. He is brave. He's honorable. Honorable and honest. He's a good person. And the fact that he has some elements of toxic masculinity actually creates dramatic tension and weight to some stories, where you wonder what decision he's going to make. And then it's cathartic when he ultimately makes the right decision.
Which he, I think, usually does, yes. So.
Yeah, that's the whole dynamic of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Where Spock is all rational thought, McCoy is all gut instinct, and Kirk is best friends with both of them and finds the right way to navigate between those two perspectives. And people praise him quite reasonably for his for what kind of decisions he makes as a captain. He legitimately cares. He might be a swashbuckling adventurer who sleeps with half the women he meets, but he's a good person.
The show is downright Freudian in a lot of ways, but it's done so well.
And when Gene Roddenberry came back for exactly two, and was in creative control of exactly two seasons of Next Generation, you find out how Freudian that guy really was.
Which episodes did he do?
Oh, he was showrunner for the first two seasons of Next Generation.
Oh, the seasons, which
it's really noticeable how different the show is after starting with season three. How different the direction is. I want to get to that. Do you want to talk about that next, or want to keep going with my personal timeline?
Yeah, what was your personal timeline? You finished Deep Space Nine, you want more. Okay. What did you end up watching?
Voyager. The most polarizing and divisive show in the history of Star Trek.
Well, it's the one I grew up with, so...
Yeah, and...
I only have kind words for it.
Me too. I couldn't help. At the time, I didn't feel ready to go back to Next Generation and see what kind of show that was, especially since the production values were basically just the same as season one of Deep Space Nine, but for the entire run, and I didn't...
Yep.
I must have been young teen by that point. I wasn't interested in seeing that. I was interested in what Voyager did because it seemed like a totally off the wall premise. They could do anything with it, and because I had no expectations of what previous Star Trek shows were like, and what anyone expected Voyager to be similar or different from them, I just watched Voyager completely on its own merits. Said, "Show me what you got," and I was okay with it. I quite liked the show. It did. It had some serialized character drama. It had a lot of episodic mysteries. It also had a lot of repeats of stories from previous shows and a really high turnover of the writing staff, who had vastly different interpretations of each character. I found it compelling. I enjoyed watching it. I marathoned through it as fast as I marathoned through Deep Space Nine.
I'm glad you managed to get into it despite it being not as good as Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I did really enjoy it, and Voyager was really got me to like what Star Trek had been before Deep Space Nine.
That makes sense.
Because it was so much more of an adventure story. Yeah, and that gave me the impression of I kind of wanted to see more of that, just more of the adventures and episodic mysteries. And Voyager also had a lot of callbacks to lore of previous shows, so I wanted to see where those all those concepts had come from.
Yes.
And that's when I finally watched The Next Generation.
You liked it even more than Voyager?
In many ways, yes. In some ways, no. But in a whole bunch, but I did feel, but as a episodic mystery show about a crew exploring the universe, it does that better than Voyager. That is an absolutely fantastic cast that they had. Their chemistry was incredible. Because on Voyager, a few characters have great chemistry with each other. On Next Generation, all the characters have great chemistry with each other. Even in really dull episodes. And there's ways that, like, the production limitations in missions end up meaning you rely more on the acting. And a lot of those actors really deliver.
Especially because you have such a great captain, so...
Picard... It's hard for me to pick Picard over Sisko because Deep Space Nine is still my favorite, but as a captain, Picard is the one you actually want to work under.
he's fantastic.
Yeah.
What did you watch after that?
After that, it was pretty scattered. I watched a bunch of the Next Generation movies to see if he's... I think I managed to watch some of the Next Generation movies before the TV show, just because I didn't want to go back to low-budget TV.
That makes sense.
TV, until I finally got...
I did watch First Contact before... years before I started watching The Next Generation.
Did not, because I kept getting gifts from my aunts of what they aunts of like, hey, here's a Star Trek, here's a Star Trek movie at Walmart. I think I did watch Insurrection first, which might be the single worst Star Trek movie.
Is that the one with Captain Kirk?
No, that's Generations.
Because I rewatched Generations recently, it was terrible.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, and when I watched Generations, this is kind of boring. boring. I did watch Generations after I was done with Next Generation. Because it's like, what happens to the crew after the events of the show? I guess this fills in the gap between the new Enterprise they have, but oh, it's just send off for Kirk, who apparently people more invested in Kirk than I was really hated the way that he died. I did that movie.
I think joke was, this is going to be big spoilers for this movie, so everyone who doesn't want to know how Kirk dies, don't listen, I guess. I think the joke was that the test audience said that Kirk should die on the bridge, and then they made Kirk die on top of some sort of random bridge.
That is, I don't know if that's actually true. That might just be a popular rumor, but that is a funny...
It has to be.
That is a funny...
It's so funny.
That's a funny anecdote.
Yeah.
Because it is... And so, yeah, I gradually soaked up a bunch of other Star Trek content. And I feel like Next Generation didn't quite become my favorite show. But it absolutely became a show I loved as much as the others.
I think you mentioned you've watched like most Star Trek shows at this point, except for Discovery.
Yeah, I was quite hyped for Discovery. At the time, I think I was a little... because in my timeline of fandom, I had seen the J.J. Abrams Star Trek when it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I intentionally watched that show multiple times to figure... that movie multiple times to figure out why I didn't like it. Because I didn't understand why I didn't like that movie.
Was it because they just kept running around everywhere?
That wasn't the reason. That was annoying, but it wasn't the... But that wasn't the reason I didn't like the movie. And yeah, so I read the El Gudeshive Q&A about where like Susan and Justin talk about what they think of the new Star Trek movie. I read that as it came out. I kind of fell into Susan's camp where it just wasn't for me. But I did love Justin's opinion on it, where he just couldn't bring himself to dislike the movie. even though he did think it was dumb and not at all keeping with the themes and storytelling of Star Trek.
It's such a weird direction for Star Trek to have gone.
Yeah, I mean, I can't criticize it. I find it hard to criticize it as a film because the acting is pretty good and...
Oh, yeah. It makes perfect sense. It seems like exactly the kind of place where also like the Marvel Cinematic Universe came from, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
A bunch of young people being in an action movie.
Yeah,
except sci-fi. It's
really just action blockbusters are a thing Hollywood loves to make. And before Marvel became the most consistently profitable and, for me, most consistently enjoyable out of all of them. Yeah, J.J. Abrams' Star Trek hit that. And it did come at a time when Star Trek was in a real drought. Because Enterprise had been canceled after just 4 seasons. And nothing else had taken off after that. I haven't seen all of Enterprise, just a scattering of episodes. That was a show I actually did watch as reruns. And I heard the last season was actually really good, even if the finale kind of stunk.
I'm currently watching Enterprise. I'm at the end of season 1, pretty much, and it's pretty terrible so far, and I'm really not enjoying it very much. But I hope it gets better.
The episodes I watched, I enjoyed because they were Star Trek. It's like, oh yeah, that sounds like, oh yeah, that looks like a Star Trek episode. These are characters doing Star Trek things. That's all right. I mean, not interrogating it more deeply than that. but Enterprise has a lot of some of the most infamous episodes in the history of the franchise. It's a strange premise to do a prequel before the Federation.
I think that idea works, but I'm just not entirely sure about the execution yet.
They were hamstrung by that lore, and sort of the most interesting stuff they did with that lore was actually when they might have been time traveling further into the future than other any other show had before, or just dealing with stuff related to that. There are people who defend Enterprise and point out how it kind of went through the same production difficulties that every other Star Trek show did.
It's a thing with Star Trek where the first season is always pretty bad, and after that it gets better.
And some of that might just be due to the difficulty of producing a show that's so different from any other TV show on at the time. Because these days science fiction is everywhere. These specific the way you build sets and costumes, that's just how TV shows are made today. But Star Trek was out at a time when that was very unique for TV, and it was science fiction was still a pretty niche audience.
It's also why Firefly only lasts for one season, for example.
That wasn't the only reason. That had its own behind-the-scenes drama.
Oh, sure.
It's drama. So no one was really making anything Star Trek at the Trek until J.J. until J.J. Abrams wanted to make a blockbuster.
Now we're in a Star Trek Renaissance, kinda.
Yeah, kinda. That movie got two sequels that I didn't have it in me to watch. I didn't care enough about those versions of the characters. I heard some really negative things about Into Darkness. I heard Beyond is actually an adventure movie.
Beyond's pretty fun. I can recommend like the first 15 minutes of Into Darkness. It has some gorgeous color stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it just looks very pretty.
Yeah, although I was the anal retentive nerd of like, hey, it's not supposed to look good. The bridge is supposed to look, supposed to have this, the bridge should have this many blinking lights and metal on it. It should look like cardboard. That's what it looked like.
I agree. I do agree, actually.
but obviously they weren't going to make a high budget movie that looked like that.
I feel like they really need to play around with more retro tech like that.
Yeah. And so when Discovery came out, I was in I was really conflicted about the state of Star Trek. Where I was concerned it would be more of the reboot universe. And I was both right and wrong about Discovery. I watched the first three episodes of Discovery when they came out. I didn't click with it. I wasn't invested in the characters, the premise, or the way it was structured, like a modern primetime drama instead of a mystery show.
Yeah.
I have friends who kept watching Discovery and fell completely in love with it as it went on. Who love the characters, love the storylines they did. And so I haven't been following Discovery, but I have been following everything else, surprisingly.
Yeah. So, Lower Decks, I assume?
Lower Decks is one of my favorite Star Trek things ever.
I still need to watch it season 2, but I quite like season 1.
Season 2 is even better than season 1, and I did not think it was going to be. Because... I really liked season 1, the whole, and that I was invested from the concept of a workplace comedy set in Star Trek. I felt like I got the impression from season 1 they were going for a little bit of a Rick and Morty dynamic between the main characters.
Yes.
And after after really enjoying and then really not enjoying Rick and Morty, I didn't want to see more of that. But season two actually fixes that problem. No, it does. Yeah, it delves more into the characters. It starts mixing up the formula of who pairs up with who. And they end up interrogating the... I mean, they don't interrogate the characters deeply. It's still an animated comedy. But make it clear the intentions were not to be a Rick and Morty clone. They were... Mariner and Boimler just have that kind of personalities between them. But there are more episodes where Boimler takes the spotlight from Mariner. There are more episodes where Boimler being a chew toy for the plot is played differently than just oh, that's sad. No, it's sometimes there's an episode where he intentionally humiliates himself to help resolve the plot, and he is 100% okay with that. He feels completely secure in his identity. He has that kind of character. I think that does a lot to address the issues I had with the handful of issues I had in season one of what was otherwise the show made specifically for a Star Trek fan like me. It's like, hey, I get that reference. I get that reference.
It's all just counting the references. this sounds intriguing.
Oh yeah, and in season two they also do one episode that called "We'll Always Have Tom Paris" that does a bunch of callbacks to the early seasons of Star Trek Voyager. So it's all in jokes for me specifically. You know, I don't think any. And I'm like, oh, I love that you're making fun. I love that you're making fun of those kind of stupid episodes.
I love Tom Paris, so I'm excited.
Yeah, and the actor who played him reprises his role in animation.
Awesome.
These work because at the end of season, it's not a is it a spoiler to talk about the end of season one of Lower Decks?
I mostly forgot what even happens in it. So.
Yeah, because at the end of season one of Lower Decks, Boimler ended up getting transferred to Captain Riker's ship.
Oh yeah,
and the first
I remember that.
Yeah, and in the first episode of season two, there's a B plot of Boimler on that ship going on a bunch of crazy high octane adventures with a sort of broody melodramatic crew that take everything seriously. and he's there as this goofball comedy character trying to fit in. But he ends up actually coming more into his own as a character and figuring out what he wants from his career in Starfleet. And obviously he transfers back to the Cerrito, so he's back with the crew from season one. You knew that was going to happen. This is a sitcom. Of course it resets to the status quo. and he just is going, hey, what was it like with Riker on the Titan? Oh, it was a bunch of serialized dramatic action adventures that made me question the whole reality I live in. So what's up with you guys?
That's Star Trek, all right.
Yeah, that's them describing how modern Star Trek is. Because it's so many incarnations, and how Lower Decks is really an homage to old Trek, but it's still respectful of all Star Trek.
Well, I'll definitely be watching that second season eventually.
Oh, yeah. A bunch of great episodes, a bunch of great callbacks to classic episodes, and hilarious callbacks to terrible episodes.
Before we go into the second half, I would like to ask, have you been watching Star Trek Prodigy?
I haven't gotten around to watching it, but I'm so glad that Prodigy is a show that exists, because it seems like a great it seems like a great idea for a show. Of a bunch of alien kids on an adventure together with hologram of Captain Janeway as their mentor. Complete with a holographic coffee. Holographic coffee. That's amazing.
So funny.
Yes, that is. That seems like Star Trek expanding into the same genre as like the Clone Wars, TV show.
It's not even their first major animated role, by the way. Did you know that Kate Mulgrew of Captain Janeway also played the role of the cat in Infinity Train?
Yeah, no, because I still need to watch Infinity Train. Infinity Train. But I was a
I was watching Infinity Train. I was hearing the cat's voice, and I was like, "Wait a second!"
Oh yeah, she's underrated talent. As a lot of people hate Captain Janeway in Voyager, and I feel like she's sort of the litmus test of whether you would enjoy watching Voyager. I loved her. Mm. I enjoyed the fact that she was a crazy tiger mom to her crew.
I think she was pretty terribly written, but I really like her as an actress.
I think she did a spectacular job at threading the needle between the different interpretations of her character.
Yes, exactly.
I liked who she was as a character. She just did crazy things in each episode because a lot of writers didn't know what to do with her character. But I was okay with Janeway as the captain who's kind of crazy.
She really is.
And she was still principled and honorable, if not too much, but I liked her. It's great that she came back.
I love all of the tweets that Dan is putting on Twitter, where it's like, oh, the kids are being like, oh, let's just go to the safe planet. Let's just do safe stuff. And then Captain Janeway is, no, you are Starfleet recruits. You have to put yourself into danger immediately. Now go to this unexplored planet that might be infested by weird danger stuff, and it's so funny.
Yeah, and Janeway is actually a pretty good choice as the annoying mentor figure taking care of kids, because she certainly acted like it was hurting children during Voyager.
Yeah, she really does. That's why she wanted to collect that many Borg.
And I feel like that
she was also like. She was also like, come on, crew, make more children. Why aren't you making more children?
I mean, that was because it was supposed to take them 70 years to get home instead of the actual 7 that it took.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Elkodish Hive. I got some items to go through, and this is already turning out to be a long episode, but it's fine, it's fine.
Yeah. But, yes, Star Trek is big for a reason, and it's hugely influential for a reason, and I love that modern Star Trek is willing to interrogate and reflect and call back to itself so much, and with a real respect for its history, and that history has had a big influence on Elkodish Hive.
It definitely did, yeah. So, giant turtle shell monstrosity. What do you think of that character design?
A little surprised by that. Sort of a moment of like, this is a universe where weird stuff just exists. Big alien creature can just appear, and characters, oh, that's that thing. I gotta go take care of that.
I love how it was actually shown. Like, it was already mentioned, and we were just like, ha, funny dad making up something weird like that. And then it was shown, and it's just such an incredibly awesome and then also incredibly cute-looking creature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any idea what its grim tidings / good news might be?
I have no idea. The fact that a turtle monster, a flying turtle monster that can see the future is here kind of means there's a lot of potential things that could happen next in this story.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate how distinctly uplifting that conclusion is, where it sort of builds up to, this is gonna be rough. Things if this means things are about to get worse. And like, I have good news. <It's> like, <"Huh?"
laughs> Yeah, I don't trust it.
I think it's a reoccurring joke at Elkodish Hive that you think things are going to get bad for the characters, and then they don't. Things end up working out because people make good decisions about their lives.
Yeah. It's like when Nanase's mom found out and Nanase is gay. And it just kind of turned out fine.
Yeah.
It was less comedic in that case, but yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that, her mom didn't exactly accept Nanase, but
Nanase
had accepted herself and accepted that her mom did love her, even if she didn't understand her. And so Anase felt ready to be the person she wanted to be, regardless of what her mom approved of. And because her mom does love Nanase unconditionally, even if she doesn't understand her, if she doesn't understand or agree with her life choices, she ends up being proud of Nanase anyway for being able to make those choices. Yeah. She's actually glad that Nanase grew up out of the need for approval or to do what her mom, what she said. It seemed like the mom was surprised by that, which is, I guess, her character development. But I think out of all the stuff that influenced Elgin Shive in terms of science fiction and storytelling, I think the distinct flavor of optimism might be one of the big of Star Trek might be one of the biggest influences on Dan.
Yeah. I think you're right in that, like, to already go a bit in that direction. Like, I think, like, one of the things about Elgin Shive is just that it's such a it always ends up well, in a way that other science fiction might not always be.
Yeah, and it deliberately references that. I mean, the Goo story arc basically ends with Elliot and Ellen both expecting to be taken away by the government for all and for what's happened, and then Ted's dad just says, "No, I'm not taking anyone away. I'm here to make sure you're all okay," and then help you all get home safely. So you can keep living your lives.
You know, worst case scenario, we just never hear about them again. Like we also experience in Star Trek sometimes.
I mean, most side characters in Star Trek get happy endings where they just where we know where they're going next and they're happy to go there.
I can't stop thinking about the fact that Captain Kirk has a nephew, and his brother and sister-in-law just kind of died on a planet somewhere, and the nephew survived them, and we never saw that nephew again. Like, it was just one episode.
This is the very first time I've heard of that character. I knew about Picard's almost son. That one episode where they thought Picard had a son. And it was 100% possible for that character to be his son, but then they found out in the last bit, no, and that ends up being character development for Picard, sort of having had to reflect on that and what he really wanted from.
Oh God, we're already getting off topic. We're talking about Elgin Shive. Okay, yeah. Elliot's backstory. We know all the stuff. Tony, it's interesting. We're not sure where it's going yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some interesting things about that with his heroism. I think NP is right now still the most interesting thing because Jestful Statement is just such a fun little arc.
Oh yeah, I'm really enjoying Jestful Statement, and I think it's a little easier to get invested in it because it's a continuous storyline following these specific characters. There's going through a personal arc.
And I just think Grace is so cute.
Oh, and yes, Grace is wonderful. And it's so great to have her back in the spotlight getting character development. Because understandably, a lot of her character arc, a lot of her baggage was resolved after Painted Black and Damien. And so after that, she was just basically ready to accept herself. And she had a few more conversations with friends and family that helped her get over the trauma of Painted Black. After that, she was just really there to be the character who isn't going through tough stuff. Because everyone else has like serious life-altering things happen to them, and Grace is just really happy, friendly, uplifting, always there for everyone.
I think there's always been like an undercurrent of Grace. Yeah, you know, Grace's trauma, of course, but also just Grace's disconnect with where she came from.
Yeah, that was the extra bit of depth to Grace as a character, where she starts off as this sort of cute moe squirrel girl who gets naked all the time, but you recognize that a lot of her empathy, compassion, and level of naivete is a product of her, of a really dark past. And she is specifically wanting to be such a kind person because she felt, because she received so little kindness in her life.
I really hope that, like, she just showed us determination in the cafeteria. Yeah. And I really hope that she just is determined to make friends with people now. And that might be an interesting direction for her character to go to, just befriending other people.
Yeah, can we make the cast bigger?
Yeah. Well, Boba and Kiki will become main characters at some point. Maybe not their names, but...
I mean, I'd love for Grace to hang more out with like Rhoda and Catalina.
Yeah. I think Grace and Catalina would get along great, so why aren't they? Well, the cats and squirrels don't play long together, but you know what I mean.
That's not the reason.
I'm worried that Catalina will eat Grace, okay?
I just think they haven't had a chance to be around each other that much, and Catalina is even more high energy extrovert than Grace is.
Yeah, that's true. And that actually kind of just makes me want to see them interact more, you know? But alright, let's go into the main topic of the episode. El Kurish Hive and Star Trek. You were talking about optimism?
I love what Dan inherited from Star Trek and all the influences that Star Trek had on Dan's storytelling is not just the optimism, but also why that optimism is cathartic. And what you need to do in the story to really build up and justify that optimism.
Why that optimism is cathartic? So what do you mean by that?
That Star Trek is a fundamentally optimistic story about people who have mostly resolved a lot of the problems they had with themselves and each other, working together to help other people and keep growing themselves as individuals to be better people who can keep working together with others, doing what makes them happy.
Yeah, and it feels very nice to see Dan present a kind of... Well, it is a kind of American suburbia that we're seeing, but it is also just like a Star Trek version of that, where everything is genuinely pretty good. And, you know, especially when we get a look into a school, like we see in Chestful Statement right now, all of these kids, they have like a flying rumor mill, but they are very nice. Like the worst that we've seen is Tony, so...
Yeah, that's also a callback to earlier story arcs. So like,
you know, made
it, it was actually a joke that Diane was alarmed by how kind and empathetic and understanding everyone was.
Yeah, something is wrong here.
It's like, that can't be right. People aren't this nice to each other, and there actually isn't anything to... she then finds out her magic is just people paid attention to her, and... These people kind of are just that nice. But even before that, there were storylines like the school uniforms.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was actually interesting because it's kind of... Susan ended up being denied her catharsis because her actions didn't change the outcome of events. They just worked out the way she wanted them without her.
Yeah.
They would have done that anyway. And that ends up... leading to character growth for her, but that whole storyline about like where the main cast interacts with all the other kids at school who have their own feelings about the uniforms and feelings about how Susan and Ted specifically react, latch on to the uniforms as examples of discrimination. And most of the people at school are actually pretty empathetic understanding, and want to be better people. There are a few holdouts who just want to keep being homophobic or sexist. And that ends up being sort of the story, tying into the themes of that storyline, and leading to character growth for everyone involved. And even Ted ends up developing more confidence as a result of wanting to speak out about it.
It's just presenting such a nice utopia. Which I think it is a genuinely representative of what humanity is like. Though also high school students are monsters. So it's kind of a weird balance.
I mean, I ended up personally relating to it, into that high school experience, because I went to a very specific high school. Well, it wasn't a private school. It was just a, I think it might be considered a magnet school. It was a school you had to apply to get in. They had a very small class size.
That does help.
It was still a public school, but a little more restrictive about who could get in. And that ended up being the perfect environment for me as a neurodiverse teenager. I felt like it was a lot healthier environment, a lot easier to connect with people, and the staff were unilaterally kind and understanding.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
I think the things that I think about when I think about the ways in which Star Trek has influenced El Gunashive, I think about the kind of high concepts, fantastical elements, like, for example, the way Alan came into existence.
Yeah. Well, I spent a whole hour, I already spent an entire episode talking about how much I love that.
Yeah, I think we already talked about how that's somewhat similar to Riker's whole deal.
Yeah, and what was remarkable about Alan is that it took that sci-fi concept, but then it didn't become a one-off. It wasn't a one-off event. It was something that permanently transformed the cat.
Yeah.
Transformed the character dynamics.
And I think we see that with Grace too, for example. When you look at Grace's backstory, which is this highly traumatic situation with an abuser, it's somewhat reminiscent of Tasha Yar, I guess, but it also sounds like something that could be a one-off episode, if I'm being honest, with a character you never see again.
Mm. I mean,
an O'Brien episode.
I mean, I loved Painted Black when it happened. I thought that was a thrilling story when I read it. It culminated a lot of plot threads, especially Grace's. But yeah, El Gunashive isn't structured as an episodic mystery the way most Star Trek is. It's a serialized drama.
A soap opera, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to say that's incorrect, but no, not really. Yeah, because that's just how. Because I mean, soap operas tend to cover specific subject matter and a lot of the things soap operas are criticized for is kind of a product of the format and the specific way that they're produced, and they kind of don't and that concept of a show that's on every day of the week, where storylines progress incredibly slowly, that doesn't really exist anymore. And it was always kind of seen as lowbrow television.
Well, I've never really experienced soap operas, but when I think of a soap opera, I kind of think of characters who are just genuinely a lot less pleasant. Like, more unpleasant. And I think that's one of the main things in which El Gunashive differs from a soap opera, in that the characters are all just so incredibly kind to one another. And that's more Star Trek, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Or slice of life anime.
Oh, sure.
Because a key feature of drama is that characters need something to angst about. They need something to have an internal conflict, and a really common source of internal conflict is the good things they want to do and the bad things they want to do, and the difficult choices they make of what kind of person they want to be. When they're torn between those different identities.
That's exactly what Elliot's going through right now.
Oh, yeah, and you could also see Ted having gone through some of that. That's honestly how you can structure any character who goes through that kind of arc.
I can think of Susan also going through that kind of arc. I think Grace kind of did, Like, she's still experiencing this thing of, I don't want to hurt people.
Yeah, and Susan was my favorite, where she where sort of, in hindsight, the different identities she's torn between is her just wanting to be kind to everyone and recognizing her own, the ways she's failed at that.
Ooh.
And trying to figure out why she has been so unkind to Ted and other people.
Hmm.
When sort of making the choice of what kind of person does she really want to be. And in the end, choosing to be one who is kind to everyone. She doesn't want to keep being mean to Ted once she learns more about them.
Hmm.
And she does a lot to interrogate herself of where that her being mean and like knee jerk angry at people came from. And in the end, she resolves a lot of that. But she doesn't have to change. But she doesn't have to change who she is as a person. She can still get angry about things that she thinks she should be angry about. But she can be nicer to people that she knows she should be nice to.
What other aspects of Star Trek do you think influenced Elgin and Shive?
Maybe just the way that a mysteries are foreshadowed, because Elgin and Shive is a teen drama, it's structured like a teen drama where characters fade in and out of the spotlight and fade in and out of the background.
True.
So plot threads will just come and go, and there'll always be loose threads from each story arc that can be that can be followed up in later story arcs.
Sometimes you only have an A story, and sometimes there's an A and B plot.
Yeah.
Or, of course, sometimes it just all goes through each other haphazardly.
Yeah, but the actual ways that we learn about how things work and the specific elements of cause and effect, that is pretty influenced by Star Trek. Because Star Trek really doesn't want to have consistent world building all the time because that gives them more freedom to tell episodic stories where they can just run into aliens that do whatever. They can just have whatever tech they need when they need it. So.
When I look at a story arc like Family Tree, where you have Eldon and Anasay going to Diane's party, so to speak, that feels like a Star Trek plot. So you have these characters going to an unusual situation, a situation we haven't seen them in yet. We see them have a good time there. We see something weird might be going on, and then suddenly stuff goes really weird, and there's an alien, and they have to solve the issue. There's even a battle at the end.
Yeah.
That's very Star Trek.
Yeah, it actually... Yeah.
Like that's not Doctor Who. Let's just say I can tell you that.
that's a different
story format.
Completely different. Okay, the fact that Star Trek was an because I do 100% agree. Family Tree actually is built up like that kind of mystery adventure story. And it starts off as just characters interacting, and then things happen, and things happen that escalate, and they have to figure out what's going on based on the clues that they have, and that series of events. Also brings out a lot of the individual character emotional ties and plot threads related to each of them. So their interactions end up furthering their character arcs. And we have A and B plot with A plot, Nanase regaining her magic for the final fight, and B plot is Diane suddenly getting roped into an adventure that she is completely unprepared for. And having to adjust her self-image to Finland. And wait, what? This is happening to me now? This is happening to my friends? I have to help them. But I don't know how to do that. Nanase, tell me what to do.
And of course, at the end, we have this villain that is kind of interesting in the same way that Star Trek villains is, where it's a pretty flat villain overall, because... A lot of Star Trek villains, like Episode of Day villains, are pretty flat, if I'm being honest. But there's an interesting... It communicates an idea. In this case, anyone could be a villain.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what Star Trek did really well with villains. That not all of them need to be new. That not all of them need to be nuanced. Some are very nuanced.
Oh, sure.
But most Star Trek villains represent something. Represent some kind. They represent some kind of ideal expressed in a toxic, destructive way.
Sure, or at least some kind of concept. Like, for some reason, the only thing I can think of is like the Voyager episode with the dinosaurs. Which is a great episode.
That's an example that I like that episode. I don't know if anybody else does.
Oh, I think it's one of the best episodes of the show.
It has one of the most anticlimactic endings of any episode I've seen.
What? Are you thinking of a different episode than I am? It's like this whole conversation between the...
The conclusion is kind of that they lose, but Voyager goes through.
Yeah, that's true. But they're just so steadfast in their opinions that it's just too...
In the end, the Voth scientist who wanted to change the way wanted to stand up to the authority in his society and the doctrine they followed about who the Voth are and what they should be, he ended up failing. He had to submit to the authority in order to ensure Voyager goes free.
In a way that's somewhat similar to the lack of catharsis at the end of Susan's arc with the uniforms.
Yeah, but that ends up having emotional resonance. I connected with that episode, I mean, it's still distinctly optimistic that it turns out so that things turn out so well, he's able to strike a deal with the authorities, where the authorities specifically holding Voyager hostage to get him to submit, and once he did, they let Voyager go because they had no reason to hurt Voyager anymore.
Well, we're going back to the status quo, you know. We have to do it either way.
Yeah, and a lot of that is a product less specifically of Star Trek and more of how TV shows in the shows from the 60s to the 90s are written. But a lot of times it's a team of writers who are writing the scripts for episodes simultaneously so they can be filmed and broadcast in any order. So every Star Trek episode starts with the characters coming to a planet and ends with the characters leaving off to go to another planet. And that's definitely a product of just the industry, but I do think that's such a lost art these days.
Oh yeah, I do. I do care about the formats, you know. There's a Monster of the Week kind of format. There's the, you have said it, the episodic mystery. And I think Elke de Schijf does communicate some of that in its format, but I also think that the webcomic format of just a story that can keep going and keep evolving is just so much better.
Yeah, I absolutely love that, the way these characters are able to change over time. I mean, the way the world around them ends up changing so much. Because there is no restrictions other than what Dan wants to do. And it combines so many different genres and influences together. I think you can see elements of episodic storytelling with characters that don't have arcs in a storyline but are still there. Because these characters show up and do the thing they are good at to help out, and they end up inspire and assist other characters, even if they don't change. Yeah. But they don't need to change. They're just helpful now as they are.
Like if we were to look at Charlotte in So It Dated the Mall, when Charlotte talks to the Griffins, just doing what she is best at, as she put it herself.
Yeah.
Of course, at the end of that arc, she did have an arc, personally, because she interacted with Deanne later on, but in an important way.
Yeah, that's what's so great. I feel like that is a really... great insight into storytelling that Dan made, that not every character needs to have an arc in every storyline, and that your point of view can be a character who is going through an arc, it can be a character who isn't going through an arc, but even in episodes of Star Trek, there are tons of episodes where characters have a arc they go through, but a lot of times it's a side character, it's a guest star, it's someone who is changed by their experiences interacting with the main cast who don't change.
I think the coolest thing in El Kunashaif is that you can have a character going through an important personal beat at one moment, and then the rest of the arc, they're just kind of there, but they are still like present in a way that changes the mood of the scene. You know, in the way that Geordi would change the mood of any scene that he's in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Even though Geordi never really has an arc other than being a creep when it comes to relationships.
Yeah, that's sort of that's another product of industry. Very few women weighing in on any of the scripts they write. So, and having to come up with what's something we do with these male characters to set plot in motion. Let's have relationships that fall apart in terrible fashion.
Data, so, Picard. Yeah. The Next Generation had a lot of bad relationships.
I mean, not necessarily unrealistic that these characters were there's dated a bunch of people and those relationships didn't work out. No, what's weird is the way that it can be framed, because Riker is as much of a playboy as Kirk is, but he just walks up to people and starts flirting.
And then the women sometimes don't respond to it quite the same way as they would to Kirk.
Yeah, I really connected more with the relationship writing on Deep Space Nine, because that's where the cast actually has romance arcs with each other.
Well, it's actually interesting now I think of it, because the romance in El Kunashaif is very similar to the romance in Star Trek, in that you have characters who fall into a relationship with each other, and then they kind of keep that relationship going. Like, it's not like they have to continuously fall in love with each other in Star Trek. Not usually, anyways. Oftentimes they do, because different writers kind of suck at writing romance stories, but...
Yeah.
Like, the power of Star Trek sometimes, when romance goes well, is just that these two characters like each other and are in a relationship together, and like Keiko and O'Brien are the best example of that, I think.
Oh yeah, because they were already married. Because they were already married when they appeared in Next Generation, so they're just married here and they're happy together.
Yeah,
but they're also in a different stage of their relationship because now their daughter's older.
Hmm. And I mean, I wouldn't say that Ellen and Nana say are there, but like you can see why I'm making this comparison. I hope.
Oh yeah, I can. And when we revisit a romance arc, it's because there's more story to tell in that romance. But a lot of times, romance happens, and then it's just factual in other actual when those characters show up that they're in a romance together.
Yeah,
they're happy.
Yes,
that's what Elliot and Sarah were for so long.
Yeah, and like the one time you might have Ted and Grace being like, I need to reshape the way this romance is working. And another time, Ted and Grace are just, you know, best friends in a romantic way.
Oh, yeah. I loved the impetus of One Way Road. It's not that Grace thinks there's anything wrong with the relationship she has with Ted. She just wanted to have more romance with Ted. She still loved Ted and wanted to be in a relationship.
I think we had the exact same thing happen with Keiko and O'Brien in one episode.
Yeah, this relationship needs a little maintenance. We just need time to work on us.
The thing is, that's the kind of story you don't get anywhere else. Anywhere, almost.
Yeah, it's Yeah, you really don't see it that much, because it's just so many romance stories are either movies that have to end at a specific point, in a relationship. Most TV dramas have it where the characters keep running into problems over and over again because you need more drama. Sitcoms are the same way.
You either have a Shrek 1, where they fall in love, or you have a Shrek 2, where they are worried about losing each other and they might lose each other.
Or Shrek 3, where they're afraid of what's coming, where they're afraid of the next stage of their relationship. You know how compelling that was.
Oh, yeah.
or better example, Shrek 4, there's an external threat to the relationship. And they just need to rebuild the relationship with each other in a way that reaffirms what was great about the relationship in the first place. And you don't see that storyline as much.
Yeah.
You only really see it on usually mystery shows, because they'll have, this is the season where these characters are now together, and each episode they will mention that they are together, and in a few episodes they'll deal with relationship problems while also dealing with the case they have.
Mm-hmm. Well, though usually in, like, detective shows and the like, they have just a million seasons of will they, won't they?
I mean, will they, won't they infects every genre of television.
Yeah.
Star
Trek doesn't do all that much will they, won't they. Like, they either decide that two characters are going to be in a relationship, and then they're just going to go with it, and maybe it would last, or maybe it won't last. It's actually interesting. Sometimes it doesn't last, right? In The Next Generation, I think, some relationship fell apart.
I think so. Most romance in Next Generation was episodic, and I do recall Deep Space Nine does do will they, won't they, and I really want to defend that, and the only defense I can have is just that I really like the couples that get together. There's Odo and Kira, OTP.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I know, like, the actors for Bashir and Garrick were up for a romance arc, but the producer, Rick Berman, was really against that. There's a great video essay by Renegade Cut about how Rick Berman, about the influence Rick Berman had on Star Trek.
I do think that, like, Star Trek kind of made it acceptable to Dan for a relationship to fall apart, naturally. Because it's not something you usually see in television.
Yeah, because it's so hard for me to point to a TV show that ever had a storyline where a couple agrees they're better off as friends. Except for a sitcom where it's just Ross and Rachel.
Okay, yeah, they're not, exactly. I was just dating, about to say, friends!
They're just dating other people right now. You know? So sitcom, but yeah, it's not just Friends, but Friends is iconic for that will they, won't.
Yeah, now you mentioned it. I think of a few sitcoms that did this. Like, I think Two and a Half Men had, like, arcs like that.
I mean, How I Met Your Mother did, like, a season where Ted would be in a relationship with a certain person, and then there would be a storyline about that relationship ending. Frasier is a pretty episodic sitcom, but there are some girlfriends who stick. Some of Frasier's girlfriends stick around for multiple episodes, and then he breaks up with them, and they're never seen again.
We do know that Dan is a big fan of Friends, by the way, so we can imagine Friends being an influence there as well.
Most people watching TV in the 90s were fans of Friends.
Honestly, El Good as Shife is a crossover between Friends and Star Trek.
Ah, it's ruined! You've destroyed the illusion! Nothing is original!
I'm actually really enjoying this!
Oh, enjoy my pain.
This is the title of this episode, the Friends Star Trek crossover.
Oh, I'm glad I could help with that.
Can we think of anything else that's about Star Trek that really influenced Elgin and Shive?
I mean, I could talk about other recent shows. We didn't talk about Picard, and I don't really feel that. I feel like that deserves its own podcast episode to interrogate Picard.
I did watch Picard. I forgot it existed. I did watch Picard.
I,
so. w-
I watched it. I enjoyed it a lot more than I should have. And I have no idea what to expect from season two.
I kind of forgot most things about Picard already, other than the holograms. The holograms were fascinating, but holograms have always been the most fascinating.
And yeah, and it was definitely, yeah, because they just started with the concept of the holodeck on the show, and then they had storylines about holograms becoming self-aware, and on Voyager, hands down, the best character on that show, who is there in every season, is the Doctor.
Yeah.
The emergency medical hologram is the best character from beginning to end. The actor has an amazing sense of comedic timing.
He's amazing.
He's also really chill on Twitter. he posted a little video on Twitter of taking down the EMH ornaments from his Christmas tree. That was adorable.
Oh, I need to follow him ASAP.
And 7 of 9 is everyone's favorite character from Voyager, but the Doctor, he was always a great character.
I'm with the Doctor 100%. He's my favorite Star Trek character.
Mm-hmm. And they even do cool. They even do cool stuff with him. The fact that he is a hologram gives him different. It gives him different skills and insights as other doctors.
This is something I really kind of want Elgin and Shive to do, like artificial intelligences. And we have one now in the form of Kevin, but I'm really not sure about Kevin. I don't think he's gonna be a doctor. Let's just put it that way.
I mean, I look forward to seeing more of Kevin, because Kevin was on screen for such a short time, but I found him so funny, and I...
It's a different kind of character. I like, something we talk about in the fandom a lot, like in the kind of weirder Discord channels, like the fan fiction writers, like making Fox a standalone character in a way. And how fascinating that would be.
Yeah, I think I think the story is settled on Fox is an extension of Nanase. It's sticking with that. Ellen is the big example of a character who is created artificially through magic as her own person.
I think what about
and they? I think the Urium robot counts as an AI, and we could and we probably will see more of that as we learn more about that backstory.
I hope so. That Gollum was fascinating, and honestly, one of the most interesting weird intelligences like this I've seen is the moment where Sarah was in her simulation and told a version of Grace to be graceful, and then she turned into like a subconscious version of Sarah talking a bit like how she would imagine Grace to act.
Yeah. And then she ends up talking, she realizes she's talking to herself. But like, Grace wouldn't act like that. What? You told me to act like this. Don't pin this on me. And she does realize that. And Sarah sort of ends up bringing to the forefront the way she thinks about herself and about other people.
I think that's more of a Doctor Who thing than a Star Trek thing, but I found the moment fascinating, so I want to bring it up anyway.
It's a pulp sci-fi thing, because...
Oh, sure.
Cause I was exposed to sci-fi first through Star Trek, and eventually through Doctor Who, but... So much of Star Trek's identity stems from pulp literature, which actually was pretty big in the '60s, but also even earlier than that, where it was supposed to be, because you could argue the example of a space adventure is like Flash Gordon, who did get a great homage. I loved the homage in Voyager to Flash Gordon.
Oh yeah,
just that. The running gag of Captain Proton on the holodeck.
I love Captain Proton.
I love the episode where they get some photonic based aliens get stuck in the Captain Proton program and think it's real, and Voyager can't turn it off. So they end up having to act in an episode of Captain Proton. That ends up being a big parody / homage to the history of science fiction, and really And it's particularly of TV science fiction.
And this also just shows that we need more space travel in Elgunashiv. Come on.
You know what? You're right. I was going to say all the reasons that shouldn't happen, but you know what? Why not? Maybe we'll get multiverse travel first.
It seems like it.
Because we know the Griffins are going to show up. If we were told at the beginning of this story arc that the Griffins are coming. I mean,
the Griffins are coming.
Yeah, everything else in the story arc has been non-linear.
Yeah.
That's okay. I can follow it, no problem. I just don't know what's happening. I just don't know what's going to happen next. Yep. We keep jumping around the timeline.
Yeah, like, why are we suddenly talking about... it's kind of weird that we're suddenly talking about Elliot's backstory. But we'll see.
I do think there's always a reason for it, because I keep... in a lot of story arcs I read as they come out, I'm wondering, where is this going? It feels like it's meandering, and then then something happens. Oh, that's why we had to spend so much time laying groundwork.
Yeah. And Dad's always been good about that, so.
Yeah.
Unless it's about Lord Tats. But that's a wrap. Thank you very much for joining this episode. Let's see. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on the Elgunashiv Discord. My full Discord username is Trekkie. Is Trekkie with 1K 140 hashtag 2230. I am also on Twitter at Trekkie 140, and I am Trekkie 140 on other social media.
So we know what to Google. Well, you can find me on mipplestrip.space. My Twitter is it's at symbol mapplestrip. You can find this podcast in all podcasting apps. The music you're listening to right now is Our Heroes by Sister Parish. Next episode, we're going to be joined by Penny. Penny and I are going to be talking about the arc Death Sentence, in which Grace is dealing with the boar. We're also going to be... talking about like the way Elgunashiv handles morality and ethics, so that might be interesting. And that's it. Happy 20th anniversary, everyone. Again, this month for real, I guess.
Happy 20th anniversary to Elgunashiv.
Thank you very much for joining me again, Trekkie.
And thank you for inviting me back. I always love talking about things I love.
Yeah, I'm gonna stop this recording.
Should I stop my recording too?